As you can see, got a lecture for you. Get ready. tonight I'm going to argue that on matters of foreign policy, we Americans are divided into two hidden camps. I'm not talking about Republicans versus Democrats, or liberals versus conservatives, or any of the schools of foreign policy that you read about in college courses versus the other academic schools. The visible terrain that we discuss on an everyday basis rests, I will argue, on two tectonic plates that are primarily religious in nature. Or perhaps theological is a better word, because by religious, I don't mean to suggest that I'm talking about Catholics versus Protestants, or Muslims versus Christians, or atheists versus believers. I speak rather of religious divisions among Protestants, between Protestants. And to be more precise, I'm referring to the divide between Protestant modernists and fundamentalists that developed in the early part of the 20th century. The great schism that generated, for example, the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. It's my contention that the modernist-fundamentalist controversy was not something that simply came in the third decade of the 20th century, came and went in the third decade of the 20th century. I believe rather that it was a major earthquake along a tectonic divide that continues to roil our world today. From its inception down to the election of John F. Kennedy, the United States, especially its elite, was Protestant to its core. Since 1960, however, this country has remade itself. Non-Protestants and non-Christians have flooded into the country. Protestants are now a smaller percentage of the population than ever before. A Protestant identity is no longer, as it once was, a requirement for admission into the elite. At the same time, a great secularization has swept the culture. It now actually makes sense to talk of a post-Christian America. Nevertheless, the crash of tectonic plates that gave rise to the modernist fundamentalist earthquake remains in place, or so I'm going to argue. Where precisely does the fault line run? Because it is largely invisible to the naked eye, it's difficult to trace with precision. To get the effort started, let's take a closer look at the Scopes trial itself. That was a moment when the intra-Protestant chasm opened up on the surface, so if we want to see it clearly, there's no better place to start. As you will recall, the authorities charged John Scopes, a substitute teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, with violating the law by teaching Darwinian evolution instead of the divine creation of man. The trial was a spectacular national event, broadcast live on radio. Clarence Darrow, the famed trial attorney, defended Scopes. William Jennings Bryan, a three-time presidential candidate and former Secretary of State, led the prosecution. Bryan, who grew up in Nebraska, was a leading figure in the Democratic Party for many decades, and he was a great populist. For several years, he had made his crusade against the teaching of evolution his signature cause. If any one man was responsible for setting fundamentalists against modernists, it was Bryan. The opposition to him was white hot with rage, as searing as any antipathy that we witness in our politics today. H.L. Mencken, the most influential journalist of the time, was the harshest critic not just of Bryan, but also of his followers, whom he derided as yokels. American farmers, he wrote, dreamed of a bucolic utopia that would bring about the downfall of modern civilization. Quote, they dream of it behind the egg stove on winter nights, their boots off, their socks scorching, holy writ in their hands, Mencken wrote. They dream of it as they commune with cattle, pigs, skunks, the Methodist preacher, the Ford agent. It floats before their eyes as they scan the Sears Roebuck catalog for horse liniment, porous plasters, and Bordeaux mixture. This utopia haunts and tortures them. They long to make it real. They have tried prayer, and it has failed. Now they turn to the secular arm, meaning the law against evolution. The dung fork glitters in the sun as the host prepares to march. For Mencken, Brian was leading the peasants with pitchforks in a holy war, quote, a jihad against what remained of American intelligence, already beleaguered in a few walled towns, he wrote. Brian died a few months after the Scopes trial. Never speak ill of the dead, the sages advise us. Mencken ignored their advice. His obituary of Brian summed up the great populist's career thusly. Quote, Brian was a vulgar and common man, a cad undiluted. He was ignorant, bigoted, self-seeking, blatant, and dishonest. In prosecuting Scopes, Mencken continued, Brian revealed himself to be, quote, a peasant come home to the dung pile. Imagine a gentleman and you have imagined everything that he was not. Clearly, the two sides in the Scopes trial were fighting over more than just the teaching of evolution. It was a conflict that pitted Eastern urban elites against rural populations in the Midwest, a contest in which centralized and decentralized models of American democracy were battling against each other. For Brian, at stake was the future of popular democracy. Quote, a religion that didn't appeal to any but college graduates, he wrote in 1922, would be over the head or under the feet of 90% of our people. The God I worship is the God of the ignorant as well as the God of the learned man. The Scopes trial was an opportunity for Brian not just to champion the wisdom of the common people, but also to denounce the role of experts in government. Scientists, Brian claimed, were attempting, quote, to set up an oligarchy in free America, the most tyrannical that has been attempted in history, unquote. Brian's jihad, then, was against the progressive vision of a managerial elite running roughshod over the will of the people. This more secular and political interpretation of his project is certainly how one extremely astute political observer understood it. This observer lamented that Brian's name had become synonymous with opposition to evolution because that fight detracted from the larger mission of Brian's career. Brian was a great man, quote, one of the most misunderstood and underestimated men in American history, former President Harry S. Truman wrote in a posthumously published memoir. Quote, he was in a class by himself from 1896 on. The man was in the forefront for the welfare of the common everyday fellow who didn't have any real representation of any other kind, unquote. Brian was a model and an inspiration for Truman, who saw his populism as an outgrowth of the greatest American political tradition. One of my tasks in this lecture tonight is to put a name to that tradition. Like Truman, I find the label fundamentalist inadequate. The tradition to which Brian attached himself long predated the rise of the fundamentalist movement. While the roots of this tradition stretch deep into religion, it also has a face that is fully secular and political. For help in seeing the complex character more clearly, let's briefly ask for guidance from the greatest American author of them all, Herman Melville. Although his finest work, Moby Dick, appeared some 75 years before Brian began his campaign against evolution, the book celebrates popular democracy in identical terms to Brian. Ishmael, the narrator, sings the nobility of mankind. Quote, men may seem detestable as joint stock companies, as nations, as knaves, fools, and murderers. Knaves, fools, and murderers there may be. Men may have mean and meager faces, but man, in the ideal, is so noble and so sparkling, such a grand and glowing creature, that over any ignominious blemish in him, all his fellows should run to throw their costliest robes. God, Ishmael is implying, made man in his image, and that fact gives even the lowliest of humans a great dignity. The narrator continues, but this august dignity I treat of is not the dignity of kings and robes, but the abounding dignity which has no robed investiture. Thou shalt see it shining in the arm that wields a pick or drives a spike, that democratic dignity which on all hands radiates without end from God himself, the great God absolute, the center and circumference of all democracy, his omnipresence, our divine equality. In Ishmael's mind, if not Melville's, popular democracy has a divine halo around it. The will of the people is sacred. Ishmael then turns to God and asks him to affirm the narrator's attribution of quasi-divine qualities to lowly whalers. If then to meanest mariners and renegades and castaways I shall hereafter ascribe high qualities, then against all mortal critics bear me out in it, thou just spirit of equality, which has spread one royal mantle of humanity over all my kind. Bear me out in it, thou great democratic God. God, Ishmael believes, is a populist. Like William Jennings Bryan, God does not approve of a religion that appeals only to college graduates. Melville brings the passage to an end by citing the earthly progenitor of the political and religious tradition that Bryan represents. Still beseeching God to affirm his populism, Ishmael says, "Thou who didst pick up Andrew Jackson from the pebbles, who didst hurl him upon a warhorse, who didst thunder him higher than a throne, thou who in all thy mighty earthly marchings ever cullest thy selectest champions from the kingly commons, bear me out in it, O God." So it's interesting what Melville's doing here. Melville is rewriting Genesis as an American story. Genesis is the only creation story in the ancient Near East that doesn't begin with a hero or with a king. It begins with man. And what he's saying is that great equality of Genesis is reaching its fruition in the American experience, in the American mission. According to Moby Dick's narrator, then, a man as great as Andrew Jackson arises from the rabble of the common people. When a man as great as Andrew Jackson arises from the rabble of the common people, we are witnessing the hand of the Lord in human affairs. But it is popular democracy that sets the scene for this divine intervention. When Bryan railed against the scientist establishing an oligarchy, he was following directly and self-consciously in the footsteps of Andrew Jackson, who fought against, in his words, a, quote, monopoly of government by elites, and who won everlasting glory in that fight by destroying the Second Bank of the United States. Jacksonian democracy enjoins the popularly elected president to use the power of the state to protect, in Truman's words, the common everyday fellow from unaccountable and unrepresentative concentrations of political and economic power. Jacksonian democracy places a deep trust in the wisdom of the common man, which it strongly prefers to rule by experts. During the Jacksonian era, this preference and many related sentiments that attached to Andrew Jackson dominated American politics. In recognition of this fact, the historian Marvin Meyer coined the term the Jacksonian persuasion in a book by the same name. Meyer defines a persuasion as a, quote, set of attitudes, beliefs, projected actions, a half-formulated moral perspective involving emotional commitment. The community shares many values. At a given social moment, some of these acquire a compelling importance. The political expression given to such values forms a persuasion. Historians, however, pay little attention to the influence of the Jacksonian persuasion after the end of the Jacksonian era, which traditionally dated between 1828 and 1848. Following the lead of my colleague at the Hudson Institute, Walter Russell Mead, however, I would like to suggest that the Jacksonian persuasion continued to influence American politics long after that date. Indeed, I believe it is still working on our politics today. Seen in this light, the Scopes trial takes on a new significance. It was certainly a fundamentalist outburst against Darwinism, and more broadly, against Protestant modernism and the secularism that was sweeping the urban elite. But it was also something more, a revolt of Jacksonian populism against centralized power. If we accept the Scopes trial as it is usually presented, that is, as a purely religious conflict, then it becomes a discrete event with only a limited relevance to anything that preceded or followed it. If, however, we approach it as a Jacksonian eruption, then it becomes part of a much longer and consequential dynamic. My goal here tonight, however, is not to investigate that dynamic in all of its glory. I'm here rather to tease out the implications for American foreign policy of the competition between the Jacksonian persuasion and its rival, to which I will attach a name in a moment. Before I do that, however, let's dig a little deeper into the religious underpinnings of the Jacksonian worldview. And how better to do that than by listening to the words of the great man himself. Like Melville, Jackson believed that Americans were a chosen people in a promised land, chosen by God for a mission to the whole human race. Here's how he described it in his farewell address in 1837. Providence has showered on this favored land blessings without number, and has chosen you, fellow citizens, as the guardians of freedom, to preserve it for the benefit of the human race. May the Almighty, who holds in his hands the destinies of nations, make you worthy of his favors. He has bestowed and enabled you with pure hearts and pure hands and sleepless vigilance to guard and defend to the end of time the great charge he has committed to your keeping. In Jackson's view, God intervenes directly in the affairs of men, and the American people influence history by honoring the covenant between God and our democracy. Jackson envisions the United States lasting until the end of days. Its mission is to guard and defend freedom. This is a surprisingly restrained mission coming from a man who was renowned for his lack of restraint. From boyhood, Jackson spent much of his life in military campaigns. For most of adulthood, he carried a bullet in his lungs from a duel that he impetuously initiated. Yet he imagines an America that is rather aloof, a shining city on a hill, not the headquarters of a global democratic revolution. Judgment day is coming, he implies, but America will be judged on its success in keeping the torch of freedom alight, not in spreading the fire around the globe. In the second half of the 19th century, attitudes very similar to these became codified in dispensational premillennialism, one of the main theological tributaries of the religious current that, by the time of the Scopes trial, would be called fundamentalism. An influential precursor of this theology appeared in 1861 in the Creedal Statement of Prophetic Times. That was a precursor to First Things. A Philadelphia-based monthly millenarian periodical. If you will bear with me, I'd like to read a few articles from the Creed, which is part of a family of religious ideas. Actually, I'm not going to read from the Creed. I'm just going to summarize it for you. I'll read a bullet or two. That Christ will soon reappear upon earth to avenge, we believe that Christ will soon reappear upon earth to avenge his elect and fulfill his covenant to them. We believe that great judgments are pending over Christendom and that all present systems in church and state shall be revolutionized by them, if not quite destroyed. We believe that only those who are properly awake to these truths and wakeful and watching and looking for the Lord's speedy return and preparing accordingly shall escape the dreadful tribulations that are to mark the last days of this dispensation, etc., etc. According to this statement, the end of days is near. The salvation of the world will come through Jesus. operating on his schedule and through his tools, not on ours. He will transform our institutions. The elect among us will be those who have shown great personal piety, and they will join Jesus in revolutionizing the world. Everyone else will undergo great tribulations. This creedal statement does not explicitly discuss the role of government, but that role is not hard to glean. Government's job is not to spread the word of God or to perfect the world. It's to protect the community, to safeguard its freedom. Man is inherently broken, so perfection in this world will not come through human agency. We believe, the statement also says, that the personal return of the Lord Jesus is the great hope of the church, to which, and not the triumph of present institutions, I repeat, not the triumph of present institutions, we are to look for the fulfillment of the great promise of the world's ultimate blessedness. Only Jesus Christ himself, not state institutions, will create the truly just society. When applied to foreign policy, this theology lends the Jacksonian persuasion the character of a sleeping volcano. When its freedom is safe, it lies dormant, neither an impediment to nor a support for any major initiative. But if it perceives enemies to its freedom, it is roused from its slumber and it erupts. Popular democracy is the incubator of God's elect, thy selectest champions from the kingly commons, as Melville put it. A Jacksonian eruption, therefore, takes the form of a righteous conflict, a jihad in H.L. Mencken's derisive term. But the appetite for holy war is short-lived. Jacksonians appear militaristic, religiously bigoted, or jingoistic to their detractors because of their sense of absolute right and wrong and their willingness to fight and die for their values. Their appetite for conflict, however, is actually limited. War for them is a defensive act. After annihilating the immediate threat to American liberty, they yearn to bring the boys home. This mercurial attitude has bedeviled any president who has ever sent troops into battle. In moments marked by threats to the nation, the Jacksonian persuasion will provide the greatest reservoir of pro-interventionist sentiment imaginable. Its thirst for conflict, however, passes quickly. Once slaked, the Jacksonian persuasion becomes a buttress for isolationism and seemingly even for pacifism. This fickleness is part of the larger paradox at the heart of the Jacksonian sensibility, namely its love-hate relationship with the federal government and a strong chief executive. Both are vital to the survival of American liberty, which is a light unto the nations. The halo that surrounds liberty also encompasses, therefore, the military. It can widen in certain circumstances to encompass the presidency and the federal government as well. But the state itself is neither inherently sacred nor even good. Indeed, when federal power or executive action endanger liberty, Jacksonians can regard both as a pestilence. As America has secularized, the umbilical connection between the Jacksonian persuasion and evangelical Christianity has become difficult to see with the naked eye. Jacksonians today come in many different religious guises, evangelical Christians, libertarians, and atheists. They tend in today's world to be more right-wing than left-wing, but historically their roots are solidly in the Democratic Party. They can also appear as politically indifferent, even ideologically illiterate. To the H.L. Mencken's of the world, they are nothing but a rabble of bigoted groups, deplorables, to borrow an overworked word. To be sure, they are nationalistic and can be inward-looking. At times, they are uninterested in developments beyond our borders, indifferent to what some of them see as the endless machinations and meaningless gyrations of foreigners. But their heritage is venerable. Their worldview is coherent, and their perspective on politics is grounded both in the American founding and in the deepest traditions of the Protestant religion. Now let's move to the other side of the tectonic divide. Historians of religion have labeled William Jennings Bryan's detractors as modernists. That label is as misleading as labeling his supporters fundamentalists. In the interests of symmetry, I will hereby dub the other side the progressive persuasion, because the views they advanced were simply the sacerdotal face of the progressive movement. In matters of theology, progressivism gravitates to post-millennialism, which teaches that the spread of the gospel, rightly understood, will produce a millennium prior to Christ's return. During this period, peace and prosperity will reign throughout the world. In sharp contrast to the dispensational premillennialism, postmillennialism downplays the brokenness of man. It highlights instead his perfectible nature and his ability to improve his own situation through his own agency, or more often than not, through government agencies. While this theology has roots that predate the 19th century, its spread and popularity are clearly tied to the Industrial Revolution and the rise of modern science, medicine, and technology. In the late 18th century, society's ability to master the material world improved immeasurably. As a result, the God of Andrew Jackson's farewell address, "He who intervenes directly in the affairs of nations," ceased to exist in the minds of progressives. Their religion evolved instead in the direction of ethical humanism. Meanwhile, the advances of modern industrial society introduced significant social problems concentrated mostly in cities. Now infused with the belief that man can liberate himself from his limitations, progressives argued that attacking those urban problems was the priority. Grounded in postmillennialism, Protestant modernism developed the religious doctrine to support these views. Modernism shifted the focus from personal piety to collective action. It therefore became the natural religious home for social reform initiatives. The trend culminated in the social gospel movement of the early 20th century. Walter Rauschenbusch, its leading figure, depicted the historical Jesus as a social activist, an ethicist who eschewed dogma. "Deeds, not creeds," might have been Rauschenbusch's slogan. The elimination of social injustice through education, aid to the poor, and government regulation of capitalism, these were now the highest calling of the Christian. The traditional focus of the church on saving individual souls became nearly an afterthought. The primary goal of the Christian life was eliminating human suffering, and this task required breaking down the barriers that separated man from his fellow man. Progressives began this task by seeking to eliminate divisions among Protestant denominations. Before long, they sought to dissolve the barriers between Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and even pagans, to say nothing of promoting equality between the sexes, races, and socioeconomic groups in America and indeed in the world. The progressive persuasion, as a result, conflicts with its Jacksonian counterpart in crucial respects. While both accord the government a vital role in protecting, quote, the common everyday fellow, unquote, the deepest concern of the Jacksonian is individual liberty, whereas the progressive is focused more intently on equality. The progressive, moreover, is eager to embrace collective initiatives, which in practice means government initiatives. While some of these will pass muster with the Jacksonian persuasion, the progressive's concentration of centralized power, even when legitimated in terms of the interests of the common man, often takes on the appearance of a threat to individual liberty. From the Jacksonian perspective, the progressive vision quickly turns into precisely the oligarchy of the experts that so troubled William Jennings Bryan. When it comes to foreign policy, progressives are inherently internationalist in outlook. The Jacksonian persuasion, with its roots in the divine mission of America, conduces to nationalism and the assumption that a resort to arms to protect American liberty is a regrettable but inevitable aspect of the human condition. Progressivism, by contrast, emphasizes universal human brotherhood, which it believes to be within the capacity of humans to effect. As a result, progressives tend to emphasize peace more than vigilant self-defense. Indeed, one pole of the progressive spectrum is an idealistic pacifism. The other pole still accords the United States an exceptional mission in the world. This mission, however, is not Andrew Jackson's notion of keeping the flame of liberty alive until Judgment Day. The mission of America is rather to use its exceptional military and economic power to help nudge the world in the direction of universal brotherhood. After World War I, John D. Rockefeller Jr., leaving behind the orthodoxy of his parents, played a major role in developing this new ideology of progressive exceptionalism. A full survey of Rockefeller's activities would take up much more than one lecture. I will focus here instead on one particularly revealing episode. In 1930, Rockefeller established a commission to study the foreign mission work of six Protestant denominations. The commission's report, entitled Rethinking Missions, A Layman's Inquiry After 100 Years, is known as the Hocking Report, after its author and the leader of the commission, William Ernest Hocking, a distinguished Harvard professor of philosophy. The Hocking Report calls on Christian missionaries to cease proselytizing. Jesus, it argues, did not offer humanity the sole path to knowing God. Christianity was the fullest expression of truth, yes, but the other great religions also express elements of that truth. The job of the Christian missionaries, therefore, is to identify those Christian-like elements in other religions and to cultivate them with an eye to forging alliances across the religious divide. The key to this alliance building was deeds, not creeds, engaging in pious activities that non-Christians could join while remaining faithful to their own religious traditions, education, healthcare, assistance to the poor, etc. In short, the primary duty of the Christian missionary should be to apply the social gospel internationally. The Hocking Report calls on Christian Americans to drop all pretense of being a light unto the nations. Human enlightenment, it claims, will come instead, quote, by way of immediate strengthening of several of the present religions of Asia, Christian and non-Christian together. Rethinking missions calls for the creation of a global ecumenical religious culture that will pave the way for universal human brotherhood. It is, therefore, a manifesto of the Protestant modernist movement. But it is also much more. Rockefeller was laying the groundwork for the ideology of an American global empire. The fundamentalist beliefs championed by men like William Jennings Bryan, Rockefeller believed, were no basis for American global leadership because they would alienate non-Christian nations. This ecumenical ideology was not the work of just a few major thinkers, men such as Hocking and Rauschenbusch. Rockefeller was simply elevating and publicizing an existing current of opinion among Christian missionaries. Call it missionary cosmopolitanism. I strongly suspect, I don't know this, if somebody knows this, I would really love to hear it. I strongly suspect that missionary cosmopolitanism was a major contributor to the development of the social gospel. But as far as I can tell, the history books don't go into that connection. If somebody knows, I'd love to hear about it. Long before Hocking was shaping the ideology of a global ecumenism for America, thousands of other Protestants abroad were already working on the implications of the project for American foreign policy. Missionary cosmopolitans like William Eddy. Born in 1896 in Lebanon, Eddy was the son of prominent Presbyterian missionaries. The culture of American Christians working in the Middle East, the air that Eddy breathed as a youth, was thoroughly infused with the ethos that eventually attached itself to Hocking's name. From the moment they arrived in the Middle East, American missionaries had no choice but to abandon any effort to convert Muslims, whose hostility to Christian evangelizing was insurmountable. Bowing to realities, the missionaries abandoned what modernists derisively referred to as the creedalism of the fundamentalists and devoted their energies instead to pious deeds that would gain the support of local Muslim populations, education and healthcare being the most important. William Eddy joined the Marines in World War I. He saw very harsh combat and lost a leg. But his disability did not stop him from re-enlisting when World War II broke out. Despite his missing limb, he ran the Office of Strategic Studies, despite the missing limb, he ran the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, in North Africa. When the war ended, he became the ambassador to Saudi Arabia. In 1947, he came to Washington, where he helped establish the foundations for the modern CIA. Warrior, spy master, diplomat, Eddie was a man of action. Hardly the type, it might seem, to dream of interfaith harmony and global brotherhood. But it was not only in embracing the doctrine of good deeds that Eddie was ahead of the Hawking Report. Rethinking Missions argues that Christian missionaries, as they abandon proselytizing, should begin behaving as if they were the diplomatic envoys of the West. The modern age, Hawking writes, quote, might be pictured as an era of foreign service or ambassadorship, unquote, in which the primary role of the missionaries, quote, will be to serve as ambassadors of goodwill between West and East, unquote. Hawking, of course, uses the word ambassador metaphorically, but Eddie's career took the logic of the statement to its literal conclusion. He joined the Foreign Service and became, like scores of other missionaries, an actual ambassador. Given his background, it was only natural for Eddie to translate Hawking's advice to missionaries into policy proposals for the United States government. At the heart of Rethinking Missions was the notion that Christianity and all major religions had an interest in uniting, because their underlying message was supposedly the same, and because they faced a common threat from the spread of irreligion. Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam, therefore, were not the rivals of Christianity. They were, rather, its allies against a common foe, secularism. The primary adversary of religious people everywhere, the Hawking Report explains, is, quote, the anti-religious element in the philosophies of, among others, Lenin and Marx, unquote. Writing in the 1930s, Hawking was thinking entirely of a cultural mission conducted by non-governmental actors. But in a Cold War context, it was hardly a leap for Eddie and others like him to turn Hawking's ideas into a plan for the U.S. government to counter the influence of the Soviet Union. In January 1951, for example, Eddie wrote General Robert A. McClure, the head of psychological operations in the Pentagon. McClure had run anti-Nazi propaganda in the European theater under Eisenhower. I still feel, Eddie wrote, that our country could earn large dividends at a very small cost by encouraging a moral alliance with Islam against communism, unquote. Eddie's ideas had a direct impact on the policies of the government, as was obvious in June 1957 when Eisenhower dedicated the mosque here on Massachusetts Avenue on the other side of Washington. Quote, this is Eisenhower talking, as I stand beneath these graceful arches surrounded on every side by friends from far and near, I am convinced that our common goals are both right and promising, unquote. In mid-century America, missionaries were modeling themselves on ambassadors, and actual ambassadors were recruited from the ranks of missionaries. Inevitably, therefore, the American foreign policy establishment's definition of the national interest began to look suspiciously like missionary cosmopolitanism. The progressive persuasion came complete with a prepackaged foreign policy. The progressive persuasion's foreign policy contradicts the preferences of the Jacksonians in myriad ways, including with respect to specific policies. I don't have time tonight to investigate this question in depth, but I would be remiss if I ended this lecture without offering two major examples. But I think in the interest of time, I'll just mention one and then actually discuss the other. The one is multilateralism versus unilateralism. The progressives regard multilateralism as an inherent value, and they love international organizations. And if you didn't know this, the creation of the United Nations and American support was the achievement of the Federal Council of Churches, the mainline Protestant modernist organization. The Federal Council of Churches, the minute the war broke out in Europe, decided that there needed to be an international organization, a just and durable peace after the conflict. They had tried and failed to get the United States to join the League of Nations. And so they decided that this time they were going to succeed, and they did. They sold the United Nations to the American people through the pulpit, through the pulpits. And that's why the United Nations to this day has a kind of, for all of its tawdriness, it has a kind of religious glow around it for a lot of Americans. That's one, and obviously the Jacksonians cast a jaundiced eye on the United Nations. Because it detracts attention from the national interest, and because it looks suspiciously like world government, like a concentration of unelected power that is going to force alien values on the American people. Okay, but let me move on to the second one, which is, look at all this that I've got on the FCC. Goodbye, FCC. The second era of policy over which the two persuasions clash is Zionism. I return to the creedal statement from the prophetic times. That's the precursor of First Things from the 1860s. We believe that in the new order of things to come, the house of Israel, or the Jewish race, shall again occupy their own land and hold the first place among the nations under the proper king, the son of David, forever. This document, you will recall, dates from 1863, the year of the Battle of Gettysburg, a cataclysmic moment. The Anglo-American millenarianism of the 19th century, which would feed directly into the Protestant fundamentalism of the early 20th century, was inherently Zionist. It was Zionist before there was an organized Jewish Zionist movement, because the return of the Jews to the Holy Land is part of the preparation for the return of Christ. American fundamentalism has always considered support for Zionism as a proper use of government power, not a vain and hubristic attempt to influence history through human agency. And it has understood Zionism and the mission of America as inseparable parts of a single divine plan. Our forefathers wove this idea so deeply into American culture that even in its modern secular guise, the Jacksonian persuasion regards Zionism as a very close cousin of American democracy. To get a sense of just how deep this belief runs, consider the petition that William E. Blackstone presented to President Benjamin Harrison in 1891, entitled Palestine for the Jews. A Chicago businessman and an author of Jesus is Coming, one of the best-selling books of the 19th century, Blackstone believed that scripture presaged the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The role of the United States was to follow in the footsteps of Cyrus, the king of Persia, and help the Jews reclaim their birthright. What shall be done for the Russian Jews, the petition asked. Why not give Palestine back to them again? According to God's distribution of nations, it is their home, an inalienable possession from which they were expelled by force, unquote. The most remarkable aspect of the Blackstone petition was not the idea of restoring the Jews to Palestine. It was the legitimacy of the project. Blackstone collected the signatures of 413 prominent Americans. These included the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, the mayors of Chicago, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C., and the editors of the New York Times and the Washington Post. My, how things have changed. John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan also signed. 5 years before Theodore Herzl wrote The Jewish State, the event that historians typically use to mark the birth of the modern Zionist movement, the American elite was staunchly pro-Zionist. Not so the missionary cosmopolitans. A key aspect of their strategic belief system was hostility to Zionism. Ever since the mid-19th century, the missionaries in the Middle East had been working to develop friendships, alliances with Arab Muslims. But the growing push in domestic American politics for the United States to support Zionism was leading many Arabs to view the missionaries as representatives of a hostile power. Zionism was responsible both for generating hostility to the missionary project and for damaging the national interest in the eyes of the missionaries, two indistinguishable values in their minds. Here, too, missionary cosmopolitanism reinforced the already existing bias of the Protestant modernism. In the World War I era, when the Protestant modernist movement came into its own, its leading lights, theologians such as Henry Emerson Fosdick and Henry Sloan Coffin, were avowedly anti-Zionist. From the pulpit at the Riverside Church in New York and from the lectern of the Union Theological Seminary, they articulated a full-blown opposition to the idea of a Jewish state. At root, their opposition to Zionism was a function of their hostility toward Protestant fundamentalism, specifically, and the Jacksonian persuasion more broadly. The modernists sought to realize the brotherhood of man by breaking down religious barriers and building a society based on reason and science. If there was one belief that they rejected, it was biblical literalism, the bedrock of fundamentalism. Because it was a literal interpretation of Scripture that drew the fundamentalists to Zionism, the modernists rejected it out of hand. In mid-century America, the State Department and the CIA were packed with Protestant modernists and missionary cosmopolitans. It should come as no surprise then that those institutions were deeply anti-Zionist. Their hostility to the idea of a Jewish state set the stage for a severe clash between the White House and the State Department during the presidency of Harry Truman. Truman revered Andrew Jackson and modeled his career on him. Not surprisingly, he also supported the 1947 partition plan for Palestine and moved to recognize Israel the following year. The State Department responded by waging a guerrilla war against him, seeking first to frustrate and then to roll back his major decisions. That fight was bitter and long, but Truman persevered, and eventually he won. Here's how, in his memoirs, he described what was at stake. The difficulty with many career officials in the government is that they regard themselves as the men who really make policy and run the government. They look upon officials as just temporary occupants. Every president in our history has been faced with this problem: how to prevent career men from circumventing presidential policy. In recognizing Israel, I wanted to make it plain that the President of the United States, and not the second or third echelon in the State Department, is responsible for making foreign policy. The civil servant, the general or admiral, the foreign service officer has no authority to make policy. They act only as servants of the government, and therefore they must remain in line with the government policy that is established by those who have been chosen by the people to set that policy. I'm going to repeat that one more time. They must remain in line with the government policy that is established by those who have been chosen by the people. Like Jackson, Melville, and Bryan, Truman celebrated popular democracy. He fought against concentrations of unelected and unaccountable power. He rejected the oligarchy of the experts. He was, therefore, a Zionist. And now I will bring these remarks to a close. In so doing, I would like to make two brief observations. First, allow me to stand like a tourist on the lip of the Grand Canyon and marvel at the wondrous chasm that separates the Jacksonian and progressive persuasions. They differ on their views of human nature, broken versus perfectible, fixed versus malleable. They differ on moral absolutism versus moral relativism, on the relationship between the individual and society. Jacksonians emphasize personal responsibility, and progressives prefer collective and systemic approaches to social ills. On the role of the government as either a defender of personal liberty or an enforcer of equality. On the mission of the United States in the world, whether it serves as a beacon of freedom or a guide to a new era of peace and brotherhood. On the meaning of history, whether it is leading inevitably to human betterment or whether it is in a holding pattern until the end of days. These began as religious disagreements, Even as God recedes from our public life, however, these disagreements persist. No, perhaps it is because God has receded that they persist. In a secular world, there is no universally recognized moral authority capable of adjudicating between the two sides. All we have now are experts, which brings me to my final observation. For the better part of a century, the descendants of H.L. Mencken, who dominate our cultural life, have presented the preferences of the progressive persuasion as if they flowed directly from science, logic, and secular expertise. Our latter-day Menckenites have painted the religious face of Jacksonianism as superstitious mumbo-jumbo, while depicting secular Jacksonians as bigots, ignoramuses, or worse. I hope you will now join with me, however, in seeing the progressive persuasion as every bit as religious and irrational as the Jacksonian persuasion. Its vision of history and America's place in it is no more scientifically verifiable than dispensational premillennialism's belief in the rapture. And if you will indulge me, I'll close this lecture with an expression of a strong personal bias. The progressive persuasion's belief in the perfectibility of man defies all lived experience, at least all of my lived experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Do we have some time for questions? And I will field the questions, but Michael Duran will answer them. Yes, the young man in the back row there, or the behind. Yeah.
First off, thank you very much for speaking tonight. And as a student of the Middle East, thank you for your contributions to the field. Fantastic.
There aren't very many students in the Middle East who think I've made a contribution to the field, so thank you for that. I appreciate that.
So, but my question would be is that going off of kind of how you ended the talk on the topic of Zionism, how do you anticipate that this divide between Jacksonian and kind of more progressive views of foreign policy will clash today with the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict as it exists under the Trump administration?
So we've already seen with Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, that's a kind of mini, a kind of minor replaying of the conflict between Truman and the State Department. I mean, obviously it's on a much smaller scale, but you saw how the elite predicted all kinds of cataclysm as a result of that cataclysm, which didn't happen. For them, they felt it was a tectonic shift, and it was in that sense. But a lot of foreign policy is just prudential judgment. So these large tectonic plates that I'm talking about, I don't think they really dictate day-to-day policy on something that's well established, like the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I wouldn't look to this to sort of guide where things are going, but it sets the larger condition for foreign policy. Clearly, we've got a Jacksonian sensibility in the White House. Clearly, how far he's going to push that is unclear. Let's make one other point about this. If you go back and you look at presidents, these are not political parties I'm talking about, and any politician worth his salt is on both sides of this divide. You know, William Jennings Bryan considered himself a progressive. So did I was a little bit unhappy using the word progressive in my talk because it's confusing because it means different things. But I couldn't think of a better label to put on it. Truman was a progressive as well. But Truman clearly had a very powerful Jacksonian sensibility. He revered Jackson. He read every book possible on Jackson. Modeled his career after him. But he was also a progressive as well.
But on the follow-up, I mean, is it the missionary cosmopolitan typically would view the Palestinian-Israeli conflict as, if only we could resolve that, we could actually create
harmony. Well, you're right. So that's, thank you for telling me how to answer this question. You can see it in the difference between Obama and Trump, because Obama I say all politicians are on both sides, but some are more on one side than the other, and Trump is clearly on the Jackson side, Obama is on the progressive side. Obama considered solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to be a strategic priority. And, as Rusty pointed out, believed it would have all kinds of reverberations around the region, around the globe even, and it would improve America's position. The other side, the Jacksonian side, would say that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one among many conflicts in the region, and bringing it to a solution, if it's possible, there'd be doubts about whether you can even solve it. Improving on it is a good thing to do, but it's not a strategic priority, and it won't change, and it won't change America's position.
Over here.
Hi. Where do you think neoconservatism fits in your framework? Because on the one hand, it seems like that's a philosophy that shares the progressive persuasion's optimism about the advance of the human brotherhood and the ultimate direction of history. But even neoconservatism, while the United States leads the world, it doesn't dissolve into the world. The United States still maintains this very unique, exceptional, hegemonic, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, kind of role. So where does that tradition that still seems to dominate much of the center-right's thinking lie in this chasm?
It straddles the divide, in my view. It straddles the divide somewhat. But it's much more on the progressive side than the Jacksonian side. During the Cold War, the Cold War had Jacksonians believe that we have enemies and that our job is to fight them. And so the Jacksonians were in favor of World War I. Once they were on the sidelines in World War II, but once we were attacked, they were all in, and they were in the Cold War as well against communism, and it's the alliance between the melding of American policy during the Cold War of both progressivism and Jacksonianism out of which you can get neoconservatism. Because neoconservative draws from the muscular Jacksonianism, but the vision of world destiny and American role, and the American role in it comes from the progressive side. But neoconservatism is in trouble now because I think these plates are kind of moving apart now. And I think we're going to see more polarization on the basis of these ideas. I don't think there's been a moment in our history when the political parties have been so clearly aligned with one side or the other. Like I say, throughout history, people have straddled both sides, but now it's almost nearly a political divide.
Yes, just two quick things. One, the book you want was published.
The book you want about modernist missionaries was published last year by Alas Nazari and David Hollinger at Berkeley. Personally, I dislike it. It's called Protestants Abroad, Princeton University Press. Really, there should be two separate reviews and first things about it. And it shows how both Henry Luce's, John King Fairbank, Edwin Reischauer, John Hersey, Pearl Buck, and a host of other modernist missionaries, how they take just the view that you're talking about. Second, you're going to have to consider this. The Niebuhr brothers, we were celebrating Richard Neuhaus yesterday, who modeled himself on both Richard
question,
and Lionel Niebuhr.
Question.
No, here's the question. Okay. Did you know that they were completely opposed on Zionism? The one who believed in Christ and who was Orthodox and close to a fundamentalist, Richard, opposed Zionism while Reinhold was poor.
Yes, yeah, Reinhold Niebuhr. There's two Reinhold Niebuhrs. And the one I like is the Jacksonian. I read the Hollinger book, but it doesn't answer my question because it starts up later. I think that the I intuit, right? Which is of course how you do history, right? You don't need sources, you just decide how things are. I intuit that the missionaries in the 19th century and the late 19th century, that their attitudes deeply influenced the social gospel. But I have no evidence of it.
Not really true, but we'll talk about that later.
It has to be true because my gut tells me it is.
So it seems to me that the Jacksonian worldview at this point has become something of a contradiction. These are the coalition that believes that the church's job is to improve society, and yet they're the most organized religious force active in our politics today. They basically believe that the church needs to wait for Christ's return before they can affect the world, but they also see it worth their while to fight secularism, fight modernism, humanism. Can you talk a little bit about the contradiction there, or what do you see that?
I think you're totally right. There are contradictions on both sides. I'm constructing like a Weberian ideal type. Which is designed to highlight the fault line between the two sides. But there's nobody out there that is representing these ideas exactly as these ideas and advancing them. And on the Jacksonian side, between, you know, I'd say secular Jacksonians and religious Jacksonians, I would look at libertarianism, totally secular atheist libertarianism, as an offshoot of the Jacksonian worldview, but a secular libertarian and a fundamentalist activist, who I would also see as Jacksonian, would be in total disagreement with each other about everything. Does that make any sense? It's these larger issues about what the purpose of government is in general, what's the nature of history. These are sort of paradigm issues that are over and above all of these political issues that we fight about.
Okay, one more question. Yes, in the Czech church.
Really enjoyed the discussion. I'd like to ask a little bit more about the section that you introduced about progressivism.
I'm sorry, can I interrupt you for a second? Because I just had a delayed thought in reaction to this other gentleman. I'll finish answering him, then we'll come right back. I lost it now. It was so brilliant. It was so brilliant. Hold on. Give me half a second, and I'll pretend you're not all looking at me right now. No, it's like this. It's, to me, it makes sense historically that libertarians and evangelical Christians would both line up behind Trump. That's not just a political alliance of convenience. It's not, let's say it this way. Here's Trump who, does anyone here want to stand up and say that they think that this is a guy for whom God has played an important part in his life, you know, consciously before the presidency? And here, I don't know, 80-some-odd percent of the evangelicals voted for him. There's a reason for that. There's an historical reason for that. Historical reason for that. That is more than just a flash in the pan. I think he understood it. He went to them, and he signaled, look, who are we kidding? I am not a pious man. But you, I respect you, and I respect the role that you play in American society. And I think that you have a right to be who you are. And I'm going to put a wall around you, and I'm going to man that wall.
A really beautiful wall.
Yeah, a really beautiful wall. A lovely wall. And I'm going to make the progressives pay for it, right? But don't look too closely. Don't look too closely at my character, right? But that makes total sense in this framework, I think. Even though there's, in terms of ideology, and the way they're living their lives, it doesn't make any sense.
All right. Well.
Oh, we got. I cut this gentleman off,
right.
And it was not a ploy not to listen to you. I don't know.
Last question.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good.
So I'm going to keep it simple. So you ascribe one side of the argument to Jackson, but then progressivism, when I think of theology and progressive foreign policy, I think of Woodrow Wilson. So like, why then did you decide to call the other side progressivism and not ascribe it to Wilson or maybe even another progressive politician from the early 20th century that might have to be able to policy?
Yeah, I don't love my nomenclature for exactly the reason that you're raising, and I spent a good few hours sitting and staring at the ceiling, and trying to come up with one that wouldn't be confusing in that way, but I just think that the worldview about perfecting mankind and bringing about human betterment and brotherhood and so on, it's basically a progressive vision, so I stuck that label on it. But if you can help me come up with a better one that would differentiate the two things, I'd love to have it, but I can't think of one.
All right, please join me in thanking again.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
You know, the evangelical activism it's a whole literature in the 1970s where you basically create an internal enemy that has the earthquake to fight against the internal enemy. Secular humanism becomes the surrogate for communism.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow you.
In other words, the Jacksonian, the religious rights activism.
Yeah.
And they follow his question. Mm. Like, wasn't this a contradiction? No, the Jacksonians they grab the state and they use it against a threat of freedom.
Oh, yeah.
And so you look at all the rhetoric about how...
Oh, that's a good answer. Yeah.
You